India has evacuated more than 300 students from Wuhan, the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak in China, where hundreds of Indians attend universities. After landing in New Delhi today, the travelers were taken to two quarantine facilities set up by the Indian Army. The plan is to keep them under observation for 2 weeks. 2 days ago, India confirmed its first case of coronavirus in the southern state of Kerala, a student apparently infected in China. The AP's Jennifer King reports on the new U.S. stance on the virus, proclaiming it a national emergency.
At a White House briefing that included other top officials, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar announced that President Trump has signed an order that will temporarily bar entry to the U.S. of foreign nationals believed to be at risk of transmitting the virus.
The risk of infection for Americans remains low. And with these and our previous actions, we are working to keep the risk low.
Americans returning from anywhere in China will be allowed into the country, but will face screening and be required to undertake 14 days of self-isolation. Americans returning from Hubei province, the center of the outbreak, will be placed in mandatory quarantine. The announcement came not long after health officials issued a federal quarantine order to continue monitoring Americans who've been staying at a Southern California military base since they were evacuated from Wuhan, China. I'm Jennifer King.
The World Health Organization is praising China's information sharing on the virus. The WHO's Gordon Galen is posted there.
It has mobilized the whole of government, set up a joint prevention task force, made scientific achievements in record-breaking time and shared them with the rest of the world.
Great Britain today is a former member of the European Union. The formal separation happened just before midnight Friday. Those who had long awaited Brexit after the 2016 referendum that approved it celebrated, while protests came from opponents who warn of a difficult road ahead. More news at voanews.com. From Washington, this is VOA News. The expected U.S. Senate not guilty verdict for President Donald Trump on two impeachment charges has yet to happen. A vote is scheduled for next Wednesday, after Mr. Trump's State of the Union address to a joint session of Congress, when he will technically still be on trial. All of this after a solid wall of Republicans prevented the introduction of new witnesses and documents into trial evidence. That prompted loud expressions of Democratic Party frustration and anger. We get the story from the AP's Mike Rossia.
The U.S. Senate has voted against summoning witnesses in the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. Chief Justice John Roberts announced the tally of the late afternoon vote Friday.
The yeas are 49. The nays are 51.
Republican Susan Collins of Maine and Mitt Romney of Utah broke ranks with the GOP and voted with Democrats for witnesses. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer was quick to react.
It's a grand tragedy, one of the worst tragedies that the Senate has ever overcome.
The House of Representatives brought two articles of impeachment against Trump in December, charging abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Mike Gracia, Washington.
As talks between the United States and South Korea over defense cost-sharing plod along, there are complaints from Seoul that the impasse is causing job losses for the U.S. ally. VOA correspondent Bill Gallo has a report from Seoul.
Camp Humphreys, south of Seoul, is the largest overseas U.S. military base. It's something like a small city. However, many operations here could soon be disrupted over a dispute on how to split the cost of the U.S. military presence. The U.S. military notified Korean employees that they may be forced to take unpaid leave starting April 1st. The furlough could affect 9,000 Korean civilians on U.S. bases. That means construction projects and other services may be paused. Many Korean workers say they're looking for other jobs.
That was VOA's Bill Gallo in Seoul. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is in the former Soviet Republic of Belarus, where he said the United States is engaging with the country politically, diplomatically, and economically. The first voting of the U.S. presidential primary season takes place Monday night in the state of Iowa, where more than a dozen Democratic White House hopefuls are campaigning for last-minute support this weekend. A predictable result is that the field of candidates will be reshaped and reduced. Polls show Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont leading the pack in Iowa, a field that includes former Vice President Joe Biden, Senators Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar, and former Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, Indiana. Once again, our top story, U.S. President Donald Trump's anticipated Senate acquittal on the two House articles of impeachment against him has been delayed until next week. More news at voanews.com. Gene Randall, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
Psychologically speaking, it will have effect, negative effect, on Nigeria citizens' relationship. I'm not talking of country, it's a state government. I'm talking of Nigerian citizens' relationship or dealing with other members of the international community.
A Nigerian civil society group calls on the U.S. administration to reconsider its travel restriction.
Instead of condemning them, instead of bashing them back, it's time now we just receive their consent. And if we have a very good country, we sit down, call various stakeholders, and address those issues. And later on, maybe the ban can be uplifted. I think that's what we need to do as a country.
A Tanzanian human rights group says the new U.S. travel restriction is an opportunity to correct the wrongs facing the country.
People demanding power sharing and wealth sharing among all the people of Sudan, and also demand development and better life and jobs and so forth.
And the Sudanese government suspends peace talks with rebel groups for a week. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The U.S. administration said it was enacting a new measure to limit legal immigration from six additional countries that did not meet security standards. The affected African countries facing new restrictions in obtaining certain visas to travel to the U.S. include Sudan, Eritrea, Nigeria, and Tanzania. The announcement is generating mixed reaction in Nigeria. Some say the ban could drive away potential investors, while others say there is need for the U.S. to reconsider the ban imposed on Africa's biggest economy. For reaction regarding the travel restriction, I reach Emeka Omiagbalasi, leader of the International Society for Civil Liberties and Rule of Law in Nigeria.
We have some reservation with respect to the ban placed on Nigerians, with respect to coming, going to America to live. Why we express some concern is because the ban appears to be a blanket ban, and I don't think the ban was able to take into consideration the centuries-old cultural affinity and relationships between the United States and the Nigeria, particularly the old eastern part of the country. While implementing the ban, we should also return to the drawing board to be able to look at how the country, Nigeria, is composed religiously and ethnically speaking.
What about the issue of security that was raised, which led to Nigeria being included in the ban?
United States is entitled to be secured both externally and internally. However, using security concerns as a condition for slamming the ban is not totally perfect, in the sense that not every citizen in Nigeria is a security threat or a threat to the security of the United States. And that is why United States government needs to go back to the drawing board with respect to the policy to be able to ensure that the innocent ones are not affected.
But don't you think the evaluation and remedy should come from the Nigerian government to resolve these concerns by the U.S. government?
That is why the government of America should come in. And that is the area they need to understand. Because what we are facing here is something that cannot be handled by the government of Nigeria, because the present government of Nigeria is indescribable. The America should not expect or rely on the government of Nigeria to do the magic, because the government of Nigeria has not found its feet, democratically speaking. So I think America needs to put all these things into consideration so as not to hurt innocent citizens of the country who are already facing traumatization and other psychological tragedies and physical attacks and violence. And that is why we are appealing to government of the America to review that particular ban.
Now, there are some concerns that a travel ban is going to send the wrong signal to investors and is going to stifle the good of Nigeria, and vulnerable people who need medication and schools will be the most affected. This is coming from Lai Mohammed, the Minister of Information. What is your reaction to this?
I don't like joining issues or responding to issues raised by any official of the present Nigerian government, because they are the cause of all these problems in one way or the other. We said the such ban will be viewed by every same person, reasonable person, as a blanket ban. And both inwardly and outwardly speaking, it has its own consequences. Yes, a lot of consequences. Some people may not be able to know this differentiation being given. The generality of people, we see it from that angle you just presented it. Psychologically speaking, it will have effect, negative effect on Nigeria citizens' relationship. I'm not talking of country, it's a state government. I'm talking of Nigerian citizens' relationship or dealing with other members of the international community, like European Union, like Association of Southeast Asian Nations, South American countries, and the North America, like Mexico, Canada, Brazil, and so on and so forth. Because America, whether you like it or not, is the world policeman. Whatever America says has a lot of consequences.
Emeka Omeagbalasi is the leader of the International Society for Civil Liberties and Rule of Law in Nigeria. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Tanzania was also on the list of African countries affected by the U.S. travel restriction. Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department also placed a ban Friday on Paul Christian Makonda, regional commissioner of the commercial capital Dar es Salaam. He is accused of gross human rights violations and playing a key role in the crackdown on political parties opposed to the government. For reaction to the travel restriction and the ban imposed on Makonda, I reach Onesma Olengerumwa, the national coordinator for the Tanzanian Human Rights Defenders Coalition.
Being listed within the list of countries like such as Sudan, Eritrea, which they are known for quite a number of human rights violations and the big human acts like war crimes and whatever, of course, it itself makes us feel like it's not something good. But what we need to do now, take it as an advantage, that it's time now for the country to sit down and look where are we not doing well in terms of enjoying or respecting human rights. This is an alert that as a nation, even though we are not violent at this time, but let's take this kind of ban and the letter from the United States of America as a warning that let's sit down as a nation, coming together, all people from various groups, civil society, the government, politicians, state leaders, and see how we can actually address those issues.
Yes. Onesmo, are you therefore saying that you are not surprised, or most Tanzanians are not surprised by the action taken by the U.S. due to gross human rights concerns or human rights violations in the country?
Yeah, we are not surprised because as human rights organization, we have been claiming there's some violations here and there. We've been issuing our reports showing that we are not doing at some areas, for example, issues of democracy, issues of freedom of assembly, the ban of political parties, rallies and assemblies, freedom of association, freedom of expression. We've been saying this openly that it's an area that we are not doing well as a country.
There are security concerns which led to the inclusion of Tanzania in the list of ban on Friday. Some people are saying that they also expected some senior government officials to be included in the ban because of the prevailing conditions on the ground. But you think this is an opportunity for the government and the people of Tanzania to sit down to address some of these concerns expressed in the ban. How do you think this can be readily addressed to meet the standards that the U.S. seek?
Yes, always, always. If there's something that, Tanzania is part of the United Nations, various international documents that requires respect and fulfill and the promotion and protection of human rights within the country. Now, it's time now. The message that has been sent by U.S. is that as a country, let's sit down before it's too late. You know, some other countries like Somalia today, South Sudan, Ethiopia, it has started like the way we are. Tanzania, we are not violent today. Everyone is calm, but violation is there. We see a lot of indicators that are telling us if you don't address them, at some point in the near future, perhaps the peace we enjoy today might not be there. So this is an opportunity that if countries, people from outside the country, tell us that we're not doing well here, one, two, three, if instead of condemning them, instead of bashing them back, it's time now we just receive their consent. And if we are a very good country, we sit down, call various stakeholders, and address those issues. And later, maybe the ban can be uplifted. I think that's what we need to do as a country.
Onesma Olengerumwa is the national coordinator for the Tanzanian Human Rights Defenders Coalition. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam.
Peace talks between the Sudanese government and rebel groups have been suspended for a week, according to the spokesperson for the Justice and Equality Movement, or JEM, Mutasim Adan. This after human rights groups demanded an inquiry into attacks in Darfur, which left at least 70 people dead and an estimated 50,000 people displaced from their homes. JEM spokesman Adam tells me there's need for an independent investigation into the attacks to determine the mastermind and those who carried out the violence so that they could be prosecuted according to the law.
We suspended the talks for 1 week, and we demanded that the government of Sudan must allow an independent investigation to find out what happened and to hold the perpetrators accountable.
If you are talking about an independent investigation, what do you have in mind, an outside group or an internal Sudanese group?
Generally, because some people accuse the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces of involving in these incidents. Therefore, an independent investigation team means an un-Sudanese investigation team, because you cannot ask the person who you accused of doing something wrong or committed a crime to do the investigation by themselves. That's why we want an independent investigation team, whether that's from in Sudan, but we prefer international investigation team to conduct an investigation about what happened and why, because there was like armed use in that incident, and not only the camp near to Ajinena, but also inside the city of Ajinena. For almost 3 days, this fighting took place in the city of Ajinena, and all the people in Krinding camp have fled away because of the attack.
After suspending the dialogue for 1 week, what are your expectations? If things don't change, do you go back to the negotiating table with the government in Khartoum?
Yeah, we suspended the talk for a week, and the government of Sudan took the case serious, and that's why the Prime Minister and Sovereign Council Vice President both went to Ajinena and stood on what is going on. And we think due to that suspension of the talk, the government took the issue serious, and at least they brought the calm back to the city, and they stopped the killing of the innocent people. At least so far, no more violence, no more killing. And after 1 week, we resumed the talk again. But the incidents took place at the end of December, and we suspended the talk until the January 7th. Then we resumed talks with the government of Sudan.
At the ongoing talks before its suspension, what were you looking at? Were you pleased with the progress of the dialogue with the government to resolve some of the concerns you have in the Darfur region?
Yeah, actually, the talks are about to bring comprehensive peace and just peace for the people of Darfur, as well as the people of other places in Sudan. As you may know, the war taking place right now not only in Darfur, but also in Nuba Mountains and Blue Nile. And after the throne of al-Bashir regime last year, the new government took a decision of bringing peace and engage in serious talks with the arms movement to address the root causes of the problem. Because, as you may know, people took arms in Darfur and the Nuba Mountains and Blue Nile, not just because they don't want or they don't like the government of former al-Bashir, but also for the injustice since the Sudan received its independence in 1956. The power controlled by a small minority group of people from northern Sudan, and the rest of Sudan marginalized, that's including Darfur and Nuba Mountains, eastern Sudan, and many other places. So the root causes of the problem are people demanding power sharing and wealth sharing among all the people of Sudan, and also demands development and better life and jobs and so forth. So these talks right now that are taking place in the capital of South Sudan, Juba, is to address the root causes of that problem.
Mutasim Adam is the spokesperson for the Sudanese Opposition Justice and Equality Movement, or JEM. He spoke with me from the South Sudanese capital, Juba. A legal advisor to Libya's National Army, led by General Khalifa Haftar, says plans by African leaders to help the North African country resolve its prevailing challenges will not work. Eldin Abdul Karim al-Shokri says Libya has a security problem. His remarks come after a recent meeting by African leaders in Congo Republic's capital, Brazzaville. The meeting aimed to find ways to help Libya address its security challenges. But Eldin Abdul Karim al-Shokri tells me the plan by the African leaders will not work in its current form.
Well, I'll be very honest with you. I know the efforts by the good efforts of President Denis Sassou-Nguesso of Congo and the other leaders. But, you know, in Libya, still the view of the Libyan people is not being considered. The Libyan people feel that they have to uproot all terrorist organizations from Libya. And any organization that supported them in one way or another, and the government that been brought, and it is only a facade of the Muslim Brotherhood terrorist organization. As long as there is some way of trying to get the Libyans to recognize the Muslim Brotherhood terrorist organization as part of the solution, the ideas itself will never be accepted by the Libyans.
Do you think that only your side of the argument should hold and others should not be listened to or respected? Is that the case? That's not negotiation.
No, there are no other sides. Please listen to me. I am telling you from Libya. I am from the inside the Libyan people. We don't see any terrorist organization hold arms against the Libyan armed forces and against the Libyan police, against the Libyan security agencies could be on the table negotiating with it.
But let me ask you, if that is the case, does that mean that what these African leaders are planning for reconciliation in the country will not work?
It will not work as long as they don't know that Mr. Sarraj is only a facade, only a face for terrorist organizations that control Tripoli and Misrata and Zawiya. That's it. And this is the, you know, if Sarraj as an individual would like to come to Benghazi and negotiate, you'll see that the Libyans will. But we know he can't because his family and his close friends are hostages inside Tripoli. He can't move. He can't do anything freely because his family is a hostage there.
This is the meeting that was held by the African leaders. Will you send a message, or will General Haftar send a message to them to tell them specifically that what they are proposing will not work?
It will not work. As long as there are terrorist organizations supported by Turkey and Qatar and giving them arms and transferring terrorists from Syria and from Iraq to Tripoli right now, yesterday, the day before. It's amazing. You know, you want the Libyan people to accept occupation, Turkish occupation on the Libyan land or what?
The African Union chairperson said that there's a resolution to convene an inter-Libyan reconciliation conference in consultation with Libyan parties, neighboring countries, and the United Nations. Do you think this will work?
Look, when was in Sabha terrorist organizations, they came and said Libyans have a quarrel, and we said, now when we got rid of the terrorist organizations in Sabha, now all Libyans are living together, side by side, in peace. The problem is not political. It's not a social. It is a security problem. There are terrorist organizations and criminal organizations armed and taking civilians in Libya, in Tripoli and Misrata and Zawiya hostages in their hands. This is the fact. All other things are not true.
Eldin Abdul Karim al-Shukri is a legal advisor to Libya's National Army led by General Khalifa Haftar. He spoke with me from Benghazi.
Kenya's High Court has ruled that the government may continue to implement biometric and use of data on the condition that it will enact relevant data protection laws. Also, the government could go ahead with a new digital ID scheme as long as it brought in stronger regulations and did not use it to collect citizens' DNA and geolocation data. Rights groups had argued the scheme violated privacy and asked the judges to outlaw the whole system. Isaac Ongiri is the Kisii County Government Communication Director, Donor Liaison and Protocol Services. My colleague Douglas Mpuga reached him by phone and began by asking him if the skeptics of the ID scheme were satisfied with the court's ruling.
There are mixed reactions to that ruling. There are people who are feeling that actually taking too long for these things the digital cards to be brought back to the people. And there are people who have actually never understood the entire meaning of this particular concept to date. So the ruling just brought about some mixed feelings and mixed reactions.
You say some people never understood the meaning of the whole exercise. And the main concern was the government was blamed on the rollout of the whole exercise. Do you think that criticism is fair?
I can say it's fair because, you know, they didn't really sensitize the people enough. And, you know, in Kenya still, the literacy level is still very high, standing at almost 60%, Douglas. So people really needed to be educated on these things. They needed to be told what this is to diffuse the propaganda that was going around that probably the government was collecting this information for ill motives. So that was never done at the beginning.
How about the fears among some people about the whole exercise, those who fear that maybe this will lead to existing inequalities and excavate debates over who is really Kenyan?
Yeah, there are fears, especially in some parts of Kenya, especially in northern Kenya or, counties that are bordering other countries. There are fears that this can be misused, especially to harass innocent citizens and especially also to fish out people who may not have gotten the identity cards, the one we have now, properly. So people thought that probably the government is going to use this to intimidate, to harass, to victimize, and to punish people. So there are such fears are still there.
Why was it necessary, or why were there fears of people that the government would collect citizens' DNA?
Oh, I think that was propaganda because actually there was really, during the registration exercise, there was really no connection with the DNA, though they collected as much information as they could, as much as the citizens volunteered. But there was really nothing, no connection at all with, any kind of DNA data.
How would you describe the exercise so far? Is it going smoothly apart from these challenges?
The problem is that though a lot of Kenyans are speaking about it, we haven't gotten any response from government on where it has reached so far, what is happening, when people are going to get back their identity cards. No one knows what is happening, save for the court case. No one has heard from the government, especially on the, in regards to where they have reached so far. No one really knows what is happening about that. And people are joking about it here. From time to time, people think that it's probably one of those scandals in the making as well.
Isaac Ongiri is the Kisii County Director of Communications, Donor Liaison and Protocol Services. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Kisii in Kenya. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the World Health Organization warns travel bans to limit the spread of the new coronavirus from China could backfire and lead to a worsening of the epidemic worldwide. Latest reports put the number of confirmed cases at nearly 12,000, including 259 deaths, with most of the cases and all of the deaths occurring in China. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
A WHO emergency committee declared the coronavirus a global public health threat on Thursday, triggering a series of recommendations aimed at limiting the spread of the deadly disease. WHO does not recommend any restrictions on travel and trade, despite the rapid acceleration of the disease inside China and its steady but relentless growth worldwide. More than 100 cases are reported in 22 other countries. In response, some airlines have stopped flying to mainland China. The United States, which has declared the coronavirus a public health emergency, says it will deny entry to foreigners who recently visited China. Australia says it will take similar action. WHO spokesman Christian Lindmeier says closing borders will not keep out the virus.
As we know from other scenarios, be it Ebola or other cases, whenever people want to travel, they will. And if the official paths are not open, they will find unofficial paths. But the only way to control, to check fever, for example, to identify travel history, to try to monitor who's coming across your border and to see whether they have any signs of infection is through official border crossing points.
Lindmeier says states have the sovereign right to take whatever measures they believe are best to protect their citizens.
Yet the recommendations stay, and if travel restrictions are imposed, then we would hope these are as short-lived as possible to try to continue normal flow of life as good as possible, but of course increase surveillance and monitoring in order to avoid the spread of the disease.
China is taking draconian measures to stop the spread of the coronavirus. Wuhan City, the epicenter of the disease, and 15 other cities have been quarantined, placing an estimated 50 million people under lockdown. Despite these efforts, the virus continues to spread at a rapid pace. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Zimbabwean government and the organization representing civil service workers have agreed on a pay hike that the administration hopes will cool down civil unrest and threatened industrial action. But not everyone is very happy with the deal. For VOA, Ade Gondo gives us more on the issue from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
The Apex Council, which represents all the civil servants associations and unions in the country, calls the deal a compromise for distressed workers, though some union representatives claim the offer wasn't enough to address their welfare amid runaway inflation and other economic woes. 35,000 members of Zimbabwe Teachers Association said the deal will increase wages by between 139% to 145%. Zimbabwe Teachers Association is instructing its members to return to work, saying the increase will take effect in February. Progressive Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, P2UZ, and the Agricultural Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, ARTUZ, however, are accusing the Apex Council of making unilateral decisions and selling out. Both organizations are demanding salary be indexed to the US dollar because the local currency is taking a nosedive. Raymond Majongwe of the Progressive Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, says the PTUZ leadership is consulting with its membership on the way forward.
We are not happy with what they are doing, and we have communicated that and communicated that very well. The truth is, we need the macroeconomic fundamentals of the country to be gotten right first. Because if government is going to allow service providers to increase service costs and then give us an increment that does not address my challenge, if food and basics are going to go up and they are not going to be able to control them, then we have a problem.
The dissenting unions say the salaries should work in tandem with the changing economic environment. Government says it cannot afford linking salaries to the US dollar. The unions say government priorities are misplaced, with corruption being allowed to fester.
We have been saying that and saying that consistently. Now, if they are going to expose the economic vagaries on us and not address the economic challenges that we are facing, then we have serious problems. It's the role of the government and all its arms to make sure that an economy stabilizes. But if they are not going to be doing it, and they live large and showing us high levels of extravagance and opulence, and then we are told austerity is the way to go, then we have a problem. The money is there, and it's clear the money is there. Look at the cases of high-profile cases of corruption that are happening in the country.
The Agricultural Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, ARTUZ, is rejecting the new deal, saying its rural membership is heavily incapacitated just getting to work. The union leadership claims its members are being harassed for failing to report to duty and that government is victimizing them.
The agreement, which is relates to an increment of a salary, does not match the expectations of the workers. The workers are demanding their salaries, which they used to earn in September 2018. And we are simply demanding the $500 that we used to earn then. If government is not able to pay us in Forex, we are amenable to getting the same amount using the interbank rate. We are not going to be settling for anything less than that.
The ARTUZ further says that the Apex Council has no legal mandate to represent anyone at that level. It charges that the new body representing workers was fraudulently constituted. The Zimbabwe Teachers Association, ZIMTA, meanwhile, has defended the decision to accept the deal. Secretary General Tapson Sibanda gives his organization's rationale.
When you push for such a negotiations, you reach a point where you can see that you can't push the employer even further. And at the same time, we are representing the membership, which is so desperate as of now. They don't have anything just to have for a day. Hence, it becomes wise at some point just to take the little and serve the member, and then you open another round of negotiation. That's the approach.
Sibanda agrees that the deal is far from what they expected, but that members should go back to work on condition that they have something in their pockets. Government is celebrating the deal, but observers say it's just patchwork for a nation with a spiraling economy and political gridlock, which observers say is creating instability. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo.
The Association of African Universities, or AAU, is an NGO headquartered in the Guinean capital, Accra. It was established following recommendations from the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO. The organization seeks to, among others, enhance the quality and relevance of the higher education in Africa, as well as strengthening its contribution to the continent's development. For more about the group, Maxwell Amuhoit, the director for North America, joins me live in the studio. How are you, Maxwell?
I'm doing well.
Well, so let me ask you, what is the mission and vision of the Association of African Universities, or AAU?
Well, like you rightfully said, Peter, the association was established in 1967, and it serves as a lead advocate for higher education institutions in Africa. It also has as its main mission to enhance the quality and relevance of higher education in Africa, and also to support the core functions of all higher education institutions in Africa, including teaching, research, and community engagement.
So why North America? Why do you have a presence here, specifically Washington, D.C.?
Yes. Now, the association wants to expand its reach to all our constituents in the diaspora.
All right.
So, last year, the board mandated the secretariat back home in Accra to establish a North American office. And the key objects of this office is to tap into the expertise of the African diaspora to establish strong relationships with institutions in North America and also to establish education networks with African institutions and their North American counterparts.
As the director here in North America, how has been the situation so far since you established the office here?
Yeah, I'll say it's been very welcoming. We inaugurated the association on 1st October 2019. That was last year. Mm-hmm. And since then, we've been actively engaging with various stakeholders, including diasporan experts, the predominantly what we refer to as HBCUs.
Right.
Yes, yeah. Then I'll say other experts over here who are engaged in research and higher education activities. It's been very exciting for this short period of our existence here. And there are a lot of interest expressed in the activities of the association, right from White House Initiative for HBCUs, through activities or relationships with NAFIO, the Historic Black Settlements and Towns Association. It's quite interesting. Mm. There's been a lot of interest here.
Mm. So let me ask you, in the next 5 to 10 years' time, mm-hmm. How do you see the Association of African Universities' presence in North America?
Yes, within 5 years, we expect to see stronger relationships or partnerships established among African universities and their North American counterparts. We intend to see more collaborative research, establishment of joint degrees, and a closer collaboration among the higher education spheres on both continents.
So talk to me about the impact of the Association of African Universities so far since its inception years ago.
Yes. Since the association was established, we've made remarkable achievements. We've granted scholarships to way over 21,000 African students. We've supported academic staff, over 8,000 academic staff, on exchange activities. We've undertaken projects worth over $2.5 billion. We've trained over 13,800 academic staff, and so many achievements, you know, so many. But these are just a few.
Mm. You have offices all across the continent and here mm-hmm. in North America as mm-hmm. well. How are the government, respective countries where your offices are, cooperating with your organization in order to achieve your mission and vision?
Yeah, I would say we enjoy a lot of support from African governments and regional bodies like the African Union, ECOWAS, and other sub-regional bodies. Actually, the association was established, like you rightfully said, in 1967, a collaboration between UNESCO, the African Union, and the university community. We enjoy a lot of support from African governments. For instance, in Ghana, the secretariat of the association enjoys diplomatic privileges. And the government of Ghana has been very supportive. It has established or built a permanent multipurpose building which serves as secretariat for the association. In Egypt, where our North Africa office is hosted, we are hosted by Al-Azhar University, the oldest and biggest university in the world. And the support is very encouraging because it is their own creation. So African governments and institutions truly support the association.
Do you think the association is helping universities to come up with policies and programs to resolve challenges facing Africans?
Yes. Yes, the association has actually been very efficient in executing this. And it does this through two main mandates. The association actually provides a platform where all academia or heads of institutions could meet and discuss topical issues of relevant interest to academia. It also comes together, brings the higher education community together to set their research agenda. And in these areas, it has been very effective and efficient.
Talk to me about the higher education space in Africa and some of the challenges that you're facing and how you intend to address some of these challenges.
Well, I will discuss this from three points of view.
Okay.
From the points of view of access, mm-hmm. relevance, and quality and equity of education.
All right.
Yeah, in terms of access, we have our own challenges, but then challenges presents opportunities as well. The enrollment within the age cohort for higher education in Africa is about 7%. And this is something we need to work on. Mm. You know, in terms of relevance of education, I also take it from the point of view that the modern education systems in most of Africa, especially sub-Saharan Africa, have a colonial legacy, where the education focus a lot on development and developing staff for administering the governments of these countries. And this has been a legacy we've inherited to date. Currently, most African countries are doing their best to shift their focus from the humanities and social sciences to science, technology, engineering, and mathematics education, because this is seen as imperative to turn their economies around, especially in this modern industrialized age.
You've heard people say African problems for African solutions, or Africans should come up with their own solutions to their indigenous problems. Mm-hmm. Do you think the Association of African Universities or respective universities that you work with have been able to step up to help in addressing some of these challenges?
Well, I would say our institutions, the higher education space, have done very well in addressing national issues. But then they can do more, even though they have their own challenges. Usually challenges in the form of funding, among others. Mm. You know, but then there is more we can do. But one thing we also note is that this is a globalized world. No one country or region can say it's self-sustenance. So collaborating with the other parts of the world also holds a key to turning the fortunes of Africa around. Africa abounds in a lot of natural resources, which we know. But the technology that we need will be more or less will be achieved, or turning these resources around will be achieved by effective collaboration or developing effective partnerships with other partners around the world.
So how do you get funding to support all the activities that you do? You talked about billions of dollars that you've used so far since the creation of this NGO. How do you get funding to do all this work?
Yeah, the association gets its funding from multiple sources. The first source is contributions from member universities, where members pay annual subscription fees to the association. We also get a lot of funding from development partners, where we get a lot of grants for the projects that we undertake. Some of our partners include the World Bank, governmental agencies like the Swedish International Development Agency, other philanthropists like Carnegie Corporation, Ford Foundation, among others.
So in years to come, for those who are listening to you across the world, what should be the expectation of the Association of African Universities across the world?
Well, the Association of African Universities looks forward to more collaboration among various actors in the higher education space, especially in the areas of research, applied research in particular. We've done a lot of research, but we need to really apply this research to turn our fortunes around. We also expect African governments to be more committed to their higher education strategies, especially the continental education strategy as developed and advocated for by the African Union, and the science, technology, innovation strategy for Africa. African governments must be committed and be prepared to commit a percentage of their GDP, which is about 1%, for research work to support higher education, and also coming up with appropriate technologies to be able to turn around the resources that we have.
Before we go, Maxwell, what is your message to those listening to you?
Well, it's a global world. And for those of our constituents here in North America, we say join the Association of African Universities so that we'll help Africa, and together we'll mutually undertake activities which will benefit both worlds, not only Africa. Association of African Universities and Africa is no longer seeing Africa as a beneficiary, but rather we are seeing Africa as a partner which has a lot of things to offer. So let's come together, let's partner, and see how mutually we can help each other.
Maxwell Amuhoit is the Association of African Universities, or AAU's, Director for North America. He joined me live from here in Washington, D.C. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. You are listening to Lava Lava featuring Ravani with Tekenya. Angelique Kidjo follows with Africa. Jules Sentero featuring Ruti and King Bayo. Dirabi will end it for us. Kenya, can you punish me, daddy?
nikimuona begi ya zikadi
kanite Kenya
moyo mpasuko radi mapigo mbio bila ya idadi
kanite Kenya
chepulake la nikiminaji mtoto nani malizia mtaji
kanite Kenya
akili kwa kiasi chaji atapatapa kama mfamaji tekete Kenya
tekenya
kanitekete Kenya
tekenya
aminishika kwenye paja
tekenya
nampaja taji
tekenya
tekete Kenya
tekenya
kanitekete Kenya
tekenya
aminigusa kwenye kwa
tekenya
yani mara uko mara hapa
tekenya
tekenya tekenya katoto kanini tekenya tekenya katoto kanitekenya tekenya katoto
mari boy
tekenya katoto
nikika tekenya kana tekenyeka yani kana cheka cheka kameni tekenya kana vetetemesh wamekitonga sekenke na sereleka
tekenya
mikono juka na mabao
tekenya
upepo suku mangalao
tekenya
ukizungusha mama na pagao
tekenya
adibirika la mwaga kahawa ukikati kakigugumizi masaika nipadawa nishatafuna mizizi wanigati shakichizi chizi
yani natapa tapa na shindo kupiga mbizi
mina mukongo ukunja mikono tuende taratibu kama kono kono
kukukishingo shingo kukukishingo
kama mbuzi kagoma kwenda
kukukishingo shingo kukukishingo
kizombi ninatoka milenda kanite
Kenya
tekete Kenya
tekenya
kanite Kenya
Kenya tekenya
aminishika kwenye paja
tekenya
na mpaja taji
tekenya
tekete Kenya
tekenya
kanite Kenya
Kenya tekenya
aminigusa kwenye kwa
tekenya
yani mara uko mara hapa
tekenya
damu gongo kishingo weka juu kunja na mikono kama kangaru
kukukishingo shingo kukukishingo
kama mejinyonga unaningini
kukukishingo shingo kukukishingo
fanya unaibuka unazamia
kukukishingo shingo kukukishingo
maramia ukuta chungulia
kukukishingo shingo kukukishingo
yani nyatu nyatu na nyatia
are you Liza?
Mama, Africa, come on, stand up and dance, you jump, come on. Huh. You're there, people,
mucho watashi wachu akanyamuneza ikose mwanu tere nambe uzu sanga duzi misaya imisambi
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impoga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Desta Wandirad, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, in a court of fowls, the cockroach never wins a case. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall. Australia.